You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 519.
Hello and welcome back to the Outdoors Station, the longest running outdoors podcast in the world. I'm your host, Bob Cartwright, and the Outdoor Station has a vast library of over 500 podcasts going back over 15 years and all still available. A library which may help you pass these long hours of social solitude and distancing we're all facing at the moment. However, I've been rather busy of late. I've now finally unpacked, sorted, disposed of, and wired up my live stream video studio. The one I may have mentioned 18 months ago. And to celebrate, I've invited everyone on the Outdoor Station newsletter to join me later today, that's Friday the 27th of March, on a private live video stream for a coffee and a behind-the-scenes chat before I start streaming next week in earnest to help people get their outdoors fix and talk gear, cooking, camping, hiking, share more stories and interviews than ever before. So I hope to see some of you a bit later today. Conversations with people like Ben James. You may remember my interviews with Dermot Cosgrove in podcast number 482 and Katie Jane Endurance, number 491, about their experiences of traversing Iceland in 2019. A tough and challenging environment, but they chose to undertake it in the better season Iceland could offer. Ben James, on the other hand, with his friend Neil Cox, decided to tackle Iceland unsupported during winter for a 220-mile crossing, potentially facing 100-mile-an-hour winds and temperatures of minus 20 degrees, pulling their pulks from Okureri in the north to Vik in the south. As you'll hear, they faced numerous circumstances which made this trip a challenge and a half. Gear failure, brutal weather, sickness, and a little bit of forgetfulness. They did it all in aid of Cornwall Air Ambulance, and the links to the charity page and numerous photos and social media notes can be found all over on theoutdoorstation.co.uk. So with my limited knowledge of Iceland and the conversations with Dermot and Katie still in my head, why on earth did Ben and Neil want to tackle Iceland at its most brutal?
I think the main reason it came about was we did it in the summer. So we did it in 2017. Myself and Neil did that. Essentially, we kind of met online. It was like a weird sort of online forum about adventurers, meeting adventurers or, you know, trying to get together to do expeditions. So I did that with Neil. Got to say, hated quite a lot of it, even though it was summer and everyone said it was not too bad a hike to do and it's manageable. I really struggled from what I remember. But even at that time, I really kind of got into the outdoors polar stuff, really, more than just the general outdoors. I've done a lot of outdoor stuff before over the years, mainly in the UK. Really enjoyed the cold parts of it, so automatically kind of swung towards doing polar stuff. So yeah, when we were in Iceland, we discussed it, discussed about other crossings, and I think at that sort of time as well, there'd been another team that had been out the winter, that same winter, I think, just before we'd got there, had attempted to do a winter crossing, and it went well. They got rescued a few times, which made kind of international news. It definitely made news in Iceland. They weren't very happy, but a lot of that was just kind of blown up because, you know, these guys just went to try and have a good adventure, and I think it took them a little bit more by surprise than what they expected. So yeah, got onto that, and then kind of from there, really, we did a few more things together. We went to Svalbard last year as a bit of a test run for cold environments to see how well we could do, and then again had a look at Iceland after that. Svalbard was difficult in that logistically it was harder to organize than Iceland. It's obviously a little bit more remote than Iceland, and after that, yeah, we both thoroughly enjoyed it, learned a lot from doing the Svalbard stuff, and then started launching into Iceland. And when we looked at it, we realized kind of how little information there was about a winter crossing. There's quite a lot about summer crossings going north to south, east to west, just coast to coast, or furthest north, furthest south. There's loads. It's crisscrossed, you know, multiple times. Other winter crossings that we found were kind of towards the end of winter, or what I would say is the end of winter, like March, April sort of time, when it's still pretty grim, but it's not the kind of dead of winter, December, January sort of crossings. So we decided then that, you know, we wanted to give it a go. There wasn't, again, a lot of information about people that completed it, or at least we couldn't find any. We weren't trying to claim at that time that, you know, we're going to be the first people ever to do it. We just wanted to be, you know, on a trip across somewhere really cold that's really remote that not a lot of people had ever done or attempted to do.
Okay, if I can just jump in there a second. So turning back to 2017 when you did the summer crossing then, I mean, I'm assuming from speaking to Dermot and Katie Jane that the weather can obviously be quite changeable, and their summer, it's still pretty chilly, but it was obviously, you had plenty of snow and ice to deal with when you were there.
Yeah, we went, I call it a summer crossing. We went May, so yeah, in theory, it's kind of getting into Icelandic summer as much as they have one. We were quite lucky at the start because a lot of the snow and water thawed, so yeah, it was pretty good. The only problem was with the volcanic ash, etc., all the snow melt had kind of soaked into that, so it was really boggy. And yeah, even May, I think, end of April, I think we started. It was just, strong winds, rain. And then we had a couple of nights where we actually got snowed in our tents. It's just so changeable. Even at that time of year, there was no kind of guessing what was going to happen. So it was a case of kind of preparing for just about everything.
So that 2017 trip then, and those conditions that you experienced then, was that the first time you'd been to Iceland? And had that really sort of cemented in your mind what to prepare for on this particular trip?
Yeah, the changeable conditions was really what, you know, I was more surprised at how quick it changed in Iceland. I knew that it was very changeable. I knew that you could have four seasons in one day. And you hear about that a lot in mountain environments, but Iceland, it's kind of its own law unto itself. And we literally would have glorious sunshine for an hour, then suddenly it would rain, and suddenly that would change to snow, and it'd be wind. It would just, yeah, all day, you probably have, you know, all the seasons twice over. In the space of a day. So preparing for that, for the summer trip, I think I've prepared correctly, but it still caught me by surprise because I hadn't realised how quickly it would change, how faff it was, because we were constantly, you know, changing layers and all of that. So it definitely gave me more to think about. I had gone to Iceland prior to this trip, probably a month before, which was kind of the end of their winter, and that was just, you know, cold. It was snowed a lot, didn't really have much rain, so I knew it was going to be really windy as well, which I planned for. But as it got towards the end of the winter, when we went for the 2017 crossing, it was definitely more changeable. So yeah, it was, prepared me for the extra stuff I'd need to take, and how quickly we'd have to potentially either dodge the weather or sit it out as well.
Okay, so now we're going on to the crossing you've just done in January 2020. It's certainly, from the Instagram pictures and Facebook pictures I've seen, it seemed like you had virtually, I won't say everything go wrong, but you certainly had everything chucked at you. Were you ready for it with the previous experience under your belt?
I think we were, actually. We did have quite a bit go wrong. I think day two or three things started breaking. The weather was, we knew it was going to be bad. We planned for it to be bad, and we packed, you know, appropriately for it, although still trying to stay light. The main problem was the snow conditions at the start were probably worse than we expected. We obviously kept a really, you know, an eye on the weather the year before as well, just trying to see if there's any sort of pattern. There isn't. It's completely random, and it will just hammer you out of nowhere. But I think we still prepared for it pretty well. We had the contingency stuff was there. We had contingency food, so had we had to sit it out for days, we would. Neil got a tent, the strongest tent he could find on the market, and then we made it even better by buying double poles for it. The tent we have is only tested to, I think, 60 miles an hour, and it's still up to about 75 to 80 miles an hour in the storms. So yeah, I think all in all, we probably over-prepared, but as it happened, it was fine. We still had a few kit disasters, which we kind of dealt with as and when, and then improvised with the rest. Just held bits together with tape and needle and thread the best we could.
And in preparing for something like this in Iceland, do you have to get the approval or the permissions as such from the Mountain Rescue, or do they want to keep an eye on you? What's the general approach to doing this type of activity?
Yeah, there's no kind of hard and fast rule for going to Iceland like that. You don't have to notify them. You don't really have to tell anyone. You don't have to get any permits. For places like Svalbard, you have to get, you know, permits, permission, all sorts of proof of your ability. Nothing like that for Iceland at all. So you could just pretty much turn up with your skis or with your boots or whichever and just start a crossing. It's probably not the most sensible. And I know they've had quite a few problems over the last few years with various people doing this and getting rescued after a few days. So although it's not, you know, it's not mandatory, we out of courtesy and not just to make, you know, headlines as being a little bit reckless, just like, you know, consulted them, and they're the ones in the know as well, so any information we could glean is going to be helpful to us.
And generally, was everybody fairly supportive to you?
Yeah, I think at the start they were a little bit cagey maybe about us doing it. They were trying to discourage us, but they were just trying to relay how bad it could be, and we would talk about our experience. The big thing that came out of what ISAR were telling us was how wet it was. So whereas we've done Arctic stuff, you know, it's cold all the time, the snow's got a lot of higher kind of air percentage that has wet, whereas Iceland, it's just wet, even the snow's wet. So that was the kind of thing they really hammered on us, and again the changeable conditions and how bad the storms were going to be. But I'd say most they were supportive when we kind of showed them our plans, showed them the kit we're going to take. It kind of swayed them a little bit, but they were still, I suppose, surprised that we'd even want to do it.
Mad Englishman once yeah. again. Okay, so for people listening to this then who are trying to visualise, just like I am, where you went, where you started, when you finished, how many days you'd set yourself, etc., etc., just give us a brief introduction, as it were, to what the route planned to be was, where you were starting from, where you were finishing, and the type of distance and time you'd given yourself before we actually get into how the days progressed.
Yeah, okay, so we started, the route started off in Akureyri, so it's not the furthest point north, but it is the largest city on the north coast. We had looked at doing the furthest point north to the furthest point south. Logistically, it was a bit more difficult getting to the furthest point north. It's not on the main road. It's not on the main ring road, I should say, rather. It's a little bit further off. And also the time as well, we had a month to do it. We both managed to get a month off work. And I think to go furthest north to furthest south, physically, it would have been far more difficult. We'd have had to take on far more kit, far more food. And we think we decided to do, you know, north coast to south coast was what we wanted to achieve. Like I said, there was nothing really, there was no kind of route plan to follow. There was no other persons done it before that have said, you know, well, we've done this route to this point in the winter. So there wasn't really anything we had to follow. So we could just make up what we wanted, really. And the plan from there was basically Akureyri and then straight up into the mountains. On most maps, it's referred to as the Central Icelandic Desert because it is just deserted in most times of year. There's nothing really out there. There's no real infrastructure. There's what they call the F roads, which are just dirt tracks that weave the way through the mountains. From there we just progressed up into the mountains. We allowed ourselves in the end, we had 28 days worth of food. We didn't plan to take the 28 days. We were hoping to do it in about 20, maybe 23, 24 days. We planned out, you know, 20 kilometer days, which we thought would be achievable with the kit we had. And then we just ploughed on straight into through the middle of the actual central Icelandic desert area.
We'll come on to the actual kit, as it were, a bit later on. But could you just explain how you were carrying your kit? Were you towing hiking carts or skis, or were you carrying it all on your back?
So we used Polks. We'd bought Polks for Svalbard, which we plan to use again for Iceland. So that's what we used to carry all the kit. To start off, because we were starting in Akureyri, it goes all the way up to the coast, and then it's tarmac road for quite a few days. So we'd had some canoe or kayak trolleys made that would fit to our pulks, and then had to kind of adapt a little bit to what we wanted to make sure they were stable. So the first 2 days, two and a bit days, it was putting our pulks on these kayak wheels and just dragging them along the main road. I think after about day three, the snow conditions got really bad, so we removed them and then just dragged it on your kind of traditional pulk.
Okay. So the first couple of days, everything sounds like it was okay. When did things start to turn interesting?
Actually, I think it was day one.
Oh, really?
Things started to turn interesting, yeah. So we'd bought the pulks. It was probably a little bit of oversight between us both. We'd bought the pulks, the pulk wheels. We bought them two different style wheels, one foam-filled, one air-filled. We both agreed that the foam-filled ones were the best ones. Unfortunately, we're preparing everything else, completely forgot to change the air ones. But no problem, you know, tyres are tyres. We then forgot a pump, so we didn't have any pump to be able to pump these air tyres up, which, as you can imagine, made it a massive drag. So I was fortunate enough to have all four air-filled tyres with no air in. So that was horrendous on day one. And I actually remember saying to Neil, I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't physically pull this pulk. And it was just because it was dragging from the tyres. So yeah, day one was horrendous. And then day two, we had a bit of a change around, had two different sets of wheels each. So we both struggled, both cursed the wheels for most of the day. And I think after that, we just kind of accepted it was going to be uncomfortable for the rest of the trip. And then as soon as we could, we ditched the wheels. It didn't get much better after that. We just didn't have to drag stuff on tarmac anymore. So that was a small bonus.
So how were you feeling at that point? Were you thinking, oh, dear, I've bit off more than I can chew. I hope I haven't forgotten anything else.
It's exactly that, yeah. I wasn't so much, you know, we'd forgotten the pump. Just thought, well, you know, we'll just have to cope without and just see what we can do. But yeah, I would say probably about the evening of day one, I was thinking, I trained a lot. I'd done ultra marathons and stuff the year before. I'd done a marathon the month before and build up. Could have just focused on, you know, getting fit for this, and then couldn't pull the pulk for 20K on the first day. And I wouldn't say defeated, but I was pretty gutted. I'm disappointed in myself. And then it wasn't until afterwards you realized our mistake with a pulk, so I felt a little bit better, but then realized how physical it was going to be for the next few days.
So when you actually got onto the snow then and sort of got started moving as you wish to be moving, how did things progress then? What was the conditions like? How were you feeling?
Yeah, it was much better as soon as we got to the snow and got the skis on. It did feel much better. We did have to, so the wheels, etc., we planned to take with us for the end because we knew at the end it would be groomed roads again. So we ended up stashing the wheels and some additional kit. We were just taking, you know, nearly 80 kilos, probably 75 kilos maybe of additional kit that we'd already decided now at that point we were going to have to ditch it if we were going to make this trip successful. Even dragging the stuff, the pulks on the snow, just too heavy. The snow wasn't quite deep enough at that point. So it was just going to grind out our pulks. So we then, yeah, already decided we had to stash some stuff, which we did. Stash some stuff at a place that we GPS marked on our GPS devices and buried in the snow to go and collect when we'd finished. So we progressed a little bit better then. Decided to shuttle stuff. The first, so day three and four was going to be a lot of ascent up to the top of the mountain plateau. So we had to kind of shuttle stuff, leave stuff, come back for it, and then set up a camp, then come back for the next stuff. So it was a lot of faffing, and it was quite demoralizing recovering ground that we'd already done. We did, you know, we made good progress, though, doing that. And then, unfortunately, day four, I was ill and woke up in the middle of the night and filled a Tesco's carrier bag full of sick. So spent the rest of the day in the tent and couldn't move, which put us a day back at the very start, really. So
okay, well, I mean, just talking about getting sick in the first place, how do you think that occurred? Was that from melting snow?
We're not sure. Both of us unsure. We, you know, all the snow that we melted, we were quite happy with, and we cooked it to a decent temperature or boiled it to a decent temperature that we knew it'd be safe. We did take some water on the river, which we'd done in previous years. In fact, the same river that we took water from on this occasion, this is the same one we used in 2017. So at the start of the route was the same. Both was unsure. There was a massive change in our diet as well, I suppose. We'd gone from eating, you know, what I'd say relatively normal food to eating, trying to crab in just over 4,000 calories a day and, you know, kind of high fatty food, carby foods, and then a lot of protein as well. So neither of us are sure. I was sick first on day four, and then I think about day six, Neil was ill as well.
Okay, so that must have been pretty demoralising when that occurred in the middle of the night.
It wasn't great. Luckily for me, I managed to contain it in a carrier bag in the porch of the tent. And it was relatively good weather when I was ill. Unfortunately for Neil, he wasn't quite so lucky because I think when he was ill, it's the day that we got hit by our first storm. So, running outside the tent into a blizzard with 75 miles an hour winds when you're sick, he probably wasn't best pleased.
Well, there's an experience never to be repeated. so taking that... those days in mind then, did you, because of your sickness, obviously you can feel particularly drained, as you say, did you stay in the tent for 24 hours and then move on the following day, and then Neil was ill, and then do the same thing again? You must have lost 2 or 3 days in the process.
Yeah, we did easily. Yeah, so the fourth day when I was ill, I couldn't move. I was just absolutely, did my legs completely. I just felt absolutely lethargic. Obviously I'd thrown up all the food I'd eaten as well, which was never going to help. That was a day of sitting in the tent. Annoyingly, it was in pretty good weather conditions as well for us to get up into the plateau, so I was kicking myself. And you said about demoralising. I felt at that point, I thought, I'm already going to hinder the expedition because I'm ill. How long am I going to be ill for? You start playing mind games on yourself that early in the expedition. It's never great. But I think we managed two more days, possibly, before Neil was then ill. Fortunately, when he was ill, like I said, it was a really bad storm anyway, so we'd already planned to sit it out, so it wasn't quite so impactive. But still, then, for both of us, having been ill and still having at least 15, 16 days to go, it was already at that point a question of how far are we going to get before we need to get help. So, morale was pretty low.
So, forgive me asking, but obviously it makes a big difference when you're stuck in your tent with somebody in those conditions. Was it just sickness, or was it sickness and diarrhea?
Yeah, sickness and diarrhea.
My word, that's not going to be good, is it?
No, it wasn't pleasant.
My word. Okay, so how long did it take you both to sort of get your strength back to carry on?
I think maybe the end of the first week, maybe a little bit more. I try to remember the exact dates. I remember I was ill New Year's Day, so that was a good start to the year. I'd probably say maybe a week after we actually started, we'd been ill and then started to come out kind of the other side. We planned the whole trip was planned to be, not using any help at all. But because we'd both been ill, we then had damage to a tent. Our kit had got wet in the storm. Basically, we were at the point where if we don't do something with our kit and fix it, we're going to have to bail on this expedition. So we managed to find one of the mountain huts there. We both managed to get in this hut. And it was at that point, really, we both kind of, I think that was probably the last day we were both ill at the same time. And that was kind of the point as well. We were both not sure if we could do it. That was just because of the illness. I think the day after that, having had to had some shelter, some actual, four solid walls, we both felt a bit better, both got some sleep, fixed the kit that needed fixing already. And then after that, I think, it was onwards and upwards.
You quickly skipped over the part there with the tent. You had damage to the tent as well. Was that purely in the storm while you were sick?
Yeah, we're not entirely sure when it happened or how it happened, but the tension lines at the bottom of your tent, it's a freestanding tent that we used, and just one of them had come away. Unfortunately, the bit of the tension line that came away is also the bit that housed the poles. So I think another couple of days and we wouldn't have been able to put the poles in. They would have just probably kicked out and been swinging freely. So that was a bit of a problem. But luckily, I'm gifted with sewing skills and managed to stitch it together, and it held out for the rest of the trip. I don't know how, because my sewing's awful.
It's amazing, isn't it, what a needle and thread will do. On a recent trip I did up in Scotland with a friend, we managed to fix two things with a mini needle and thread that we happened to be carrying between us. It was fantastic. They lasted the complete journey, the rest of the journey. So it's always good to carry a needle and thread.
Always.
Anyway, so you left the hut, hopefully having rested, as you say, and sort of recharged your batteries and had time to get some food into you. Even though you were sick, you must have been sort of trying to stack the calories away. Did things improve after that?
I think the weather got worse after that, but I think our morale was better. We got past a point. There was a team ahead of us at the same time, actually, just to mention that. So they'd left just before us, trying to do the same thing. They'd got to the same hut, actually, about 2 days maybe before us, and they'd left at that point. They'd arranged rescue. So I think at that point, knowing that we'd managed to get out of the hut and go on a bit, we felt a bit better that we'd managed to make it a little bit further. We weren't trying to do it competitively, but I think for our own morale, knowing that we'd managed to push on was really good for us. We pushed on into worse weather conditions, but I think knowing that we'd managed to already survive that one storm, we knew we could do it again, really. And the only kind of question was tent. I was just hoping my sewing could hold out.
And had you got as far as the national park at this stage?
Yeah, so I think just touched into it after we left the hut. I try to remember the boundary starts exactly, but it was around where this hut was. So yeah, we just managed to get into the park then.
So what happened in the next few days?
Just storm after storm. It was kind of limping between storms and setting up the tent. So we planned 20k days. It ended up being really frustrating because we'd end up cutting our days short because midday a storm would roll in. So we'd do 7 or 8k, have to stop, put up the tent before the storm came in, sit that out for a little bit. Then the next day there'd be like a 3-hour window, 4-hour window. We'd have to quickly get the kit down. And it was just doing little bits here and there, which got quite frustrating. We both felt quite fit. We were well rested now. I think it was 4 storms at least. Afterwards, when we finished, we're told it's been one of the worst Januaries they've had for 10 years for storms. They normally have one big storm, one big weather warning, maybe two. But for the number that we'd had and the time we'd been there, it was pretty bad. Most of the time, we were navigating in whiteouts. And I think we saw the sun probably about 3 times in the whole month we were there.
You're listening to the award-winning outdoorstation.co.uk. Sharing the passion, appreciation, and understanding for the outdoors world.
For people that sort of have an idea what a storm might consist of, could you sort of verbalise it for us and describe what a storm in Iceland, in these conditions at the time you were doing this, actually felt like and what it looked like?
Yeah, I suppose I'll start with look like. We couldn't see anything. We skied using, so this time, knowing that the conditions were going to be bad, we preloaded the routes onto smartwatches. Compasses, experienced it in Svalbard. The compasses had frozen if we left them out for too long. Trying to walk with your GPS or trying to ski with a GPS unit in your hand was hard work. So we used the watches, which helped, and that was our only way really of seeing where we were going. So we normally kept a decent sort of distance together, probably about, I'd say, 5 or 6 meters was what the optimal. Even then, there were times I couldn't see Neil. It's just, you just don't know where you're going at all. We were getting hit by pretty strong winds. We'd only planned to move in winds up to about 30 or 40 miles an hour. Anything above that was either going to be dangerous because of the wind chill as well, or just exhausting because you're fighting against them. And there's no kind of hard and fast rule in Iceland where the wind comes from. You'd be walking with a tailwind and the next minute it'll change and hit you in the face. So yeah, there was contending with that. There's the terrain as well. Because of the whiteouts, we were suddenly going up hills, or then suddenly going down hills. I'm not a competent skier at all by any means, so I really struggled then with not being able to see the hills that I was falling down. We had the spin drift smashing you in the face, so everything was covered head to toe. Again, like I said, about the wind chill. So we had days where it was minus 20 already, and then you had the wind to contend with as well. Ski goggles, you just couldn't see out of them because they froze, even though they're all anti-fogging, all that fancy stuff now. But regardless of that, they still froze. It was pretty horrible, to be honest. The days that we got the tent up and stopped was fantastic. I think the best time for us was just to keep moving because it was the only time you were truly warm. Stopping to put the tent up was obviously a bit of faffing around, you got cold. So the storms in Iceland are definitely interesting, and I've experienced strong winds etc. in other places, but nothing to that degree and nothing that's changed quite so quickly either.
I remember Katie making a point saying that one of the things that troubled her was the volcanic ash. When that gets whipped up by the wind, it can really lash out at you. Did you have any problems with the grit, or was it just purely, thankfully, snow, as it were?
Yeah, luckily for us, it was just the snow. We had a decent snow coverage, so we didn't have to experience any of that. I remember, going in the summer, and having that same experience, and it was horrible. Everything's just covered in like a thin layer of dust and ash. But no, it was just dealing with the snow this time, and it just got, you know, all the jackets these days, your Gore-Tex and whatever equipment you use is obviously designed to be pretty much bomb proof. But even then, we were taking our jackets off at the end of the day with snow basically on the inside of our jackets, because it just gets through everything and anything, then froze inside our jackets and froze to us, and then things got wet again. So yeah, it's just no avoiding it.
And just again, just to give people an idea, you've explained beautifully what the storm was like, and as you say, keeping moving was the only way to keep warm. But what were you actually wearing while you were in those conditions? You must have had multiple layers on just to stop the wind chill.
Yeah, there was a couple of days. It varied, really. So my base layer was always a merino layer. Quite like using merino. I've used it for a while. It works for me, so I stuck with that. I'd have that as my base layer. I'd have a fleece, which got through Montaigne, which was this new kind of fancy alpha fleece that I think quite a lot of the big outdoor companies use now. That was brilliant. It just wicks away the sweat as well, because obviously as you're working, you still sweat. And it was just trying to get the balance of not sweating too much while still trying to move at a decent pace, because we had a couple of days where we had to sweat a lot and then stop to eat or drink, and then our sweat had frozen on our clothes. So the mid layer was quite important to get right. I had two Gore-Tex jackets for me. So I had I think they're called Gore-Tex Pro, which is your kind of tougher, thicker one. And then I had a Gore-Tex active layer as well. And that was mainly because I knew potentially it was going to get really wet. So we kind of thought, as we got out of the Highland sort of area, it would get wetter. So I had the option there of a second jacket if I needed it. As it happened, that ended up as being just a couple of days where I wore both, because the wind chill was that bad. It actually cut straight through my Gore-Tex Pro jacket, which I've never had before. And we had sort of normal insulation jackets as well. We took all synthetic stuff with us as well, because we knew Iceland's wet, down stuff was going to get ruined. So we had a kind of a lightweight synthetic jacket, and then a heavyweight one as well, just in case it got really bad.
So when you finished the day and you got into the shelter, into the tent, and you've obviously got wet gear, which is either wet from sweat or wet from snow, what was it like in the morning? Was it still sodden, or did it freeze, or did you put it in the tent with you and wrap it in the sleeping bag to sort of keep it warm or dry it out somehow?
Yeah, probably the most unadvisable thing you could do on a cold trip, and we kept it on, wore it just to try and dry it out. So the Gore-Tex, we would chisel off the snow with our tent brush and pan that we took as best we could, then wear it to thaw it out and dry it. Any kind of headwear, balaclavas, obviously when they defrosted, kept wet, so we just wore them. And then because we had synthetic sleeping bags, we were putting our gloves and stuff inside the sleeping bags with us. We weren't too worried about the sleeping bags getting wet, because synthetic insulation will still keep you warm even if it gets wet. So yeah, it was almost every night was kind of a finding different ways to dry stuff. Neil did bring a small pocket fan with him, which we argued about, but debated and joked about prior to the trip. But I was adamant we didn't need to take it. But I will admit defeat, and it did help. So we would hang stuff up at the top of the tent as well, and have this battery-powered fan blowing on the stuff as well, which I'll say it did help the drying process.
You sure he didn't take it just for his hair?
He may well have. He may well have. I can't tell you. I still couldn't believe he took it, but I had to admit defeat in the end. It did help.
So in the process that you're using, I'm guessing, just from experience, I'm guessing nothing really dried out for the whole trip.
It wasn't too bad, actually. I think the small bits, gloves, balaclavas and all, they took a while to dry, but we just kept them on. And I'd say by the morning, most of the stuff had dried out. The Gore-Tex, not so much. I think by the end of the trip, we just gave up with wearing it, because it was miserable sitting in the tent in your wet or semi-frozen Gore-Tex. We just brushed off and chiseled off the best we could, and then stuck it in a dry bag to stop it making condensation in the tent. But I think largely most of the stuff, the gloves and all, the balaclavas, we just wore them or kept them as sleeping bags until dry, and for most of the trip that worked.
Well, I've been looking at your Facebook page, which has basically described, as you have done really, the first sort of 10 days, 2 weeks, and the sort of conditions you went through and the experiences you had with the tent and the sickness and so on. But there doesn't seem to be the sort of the story between what happened after that and actually getting to the destination, the final destination.
I think so my Facebook page, when I was away, my other half was pretty kind to kind of maintain that, just to post stuff on there, and she's probably a little bit better at describing stuff than me, whereas I think I was just kind of head down and crack on. So that's probably why it gets less descriptive, because it's when I started taking over, when I got signal again. After the sickness and the storm, it didn't really get much better. It was pretty much the same. We just weren't sick anymore. We spent most of the time trudging through deep snow. We had a lot of snow drift as well, with a strong wind. So underfoot, it became physically harder. We then spent a couple of days. We're quite lucky that we managed to get back onto the kind of one of the F roads, which had frozen. So we had about half a day, maybe a day, skiing on ice, which was fantastic. And that's probably one of the better days we had out of there. But it never lasts. And again, we got hammered by the remaining two storms as we approached kind of civilization again. We went through the area around the Hekla volcano, so it's all the pumice fields as well. And that's where we had to kind of ditch our skis and start walking. That again, I was quite glad to walk because I'm a rubbish skier. I think Neil was probably quite happy skiing, but for me, the walking was a bonus. Until about after the first day of walking, our bodies just gave up. We both had a lot of injuries, problems with our legs, problems with our feet. We were walking in ski boots as well, which didn't help. And then by the last day, we were both in quite a state. And it was kind of a hobble to the coast for the last 20-odd K.
And I presume the last 20-odd K, looking at the map of Iceland as I am now, you just sort of emerge out of the wilderness onto the roads. You must have had a bit of a strange reception from people that were greeting you or acknowledging you as you got closer to the coast.
Yeah, it was quite weird towards the end. When we started, we had a lot of people stopping, asking us, speaking to us, talking to us about the trip, telling us not to do it, telling us it was silly, don't go into the mountains in winter. But people really interested in what we were doing. Towards the end of the trip, so we must have hit civilization, I can't remember now, maybe 4 or 5 days before we ended. And no one really was, kind of didn't really bat an eyelid. I guess when we get past the kind of the Hekla volcano area, it's quite a well-known hiking route anyway. And there's quite a lot of routes around there that people use recreationally, tourists and all. So I don't think it's as uncommon to see two strange people dragging stuff through the middle of Iceland there so much. But when we did finish, we finished at the coast, and we walked back up to the nearest. Oh, well, there was a hotel there, which unfortunately wasn't open. But we spoke to the owner, who was absolutely amazed at what we had done, and I think that put it into perspective to us again that you got the people that live there all year round couldn't quite believe that we were stupid enough to go and even try this trip.
Mm. And so what about your injuries then? What had you suffered from? Did you just take the ski boots and that's all for footwear and that was causing the problem? Or were there other injuries that you'd picked up from just falling and sliding?
Yeah, I think for me, I managed to get blisters on this trip, they were pretty painful from about day one and two. And that was from walking. When I was skiing, it was fine, not so much of a problem. And also again, when we started walking again in the end, it just flared up again. I can't really explain why or how, but we both had a lot of problems with our legs. Neil had ankle problems, not so much just from walking in the ski boots, but I can only assume we hadn't walked for a couple of weeks and used those muscles. We'd lost a lot of weight, so I imagine a lot of muscle had gone with that. So whether it was a case of our bodies had just deteriorated or those muscles had deteriorated from lack of use, it just made it really hard going. I know Neil got blisters as well towards the end, adding to the fact that he was hobbling didn't help. I slipped on some ice and hit my knee, which nothing major. Didn't think anything of it at the time. And then the next day it became a bit of a mission to walk without making that worse. So, just a combination of things made it a bit of a nightmare.
Well, you certainly had a heck of an experience, and from your previous experience, you'd prepared yourself fairly well by the sound of it. But what was your biggest fear on the trip itself, and did you ever come close to facing it?
I think my biggest fear was both of us didn't want to fail, but we had accepted prior to doing it because not, as far as we knew, no one had in recent times successfully crossed it. So I think for me, the biggest fear was failure. And although that kind of puts more pressure on, on us, I'm not sure why. I wasn't too worried about the conditions. I was you know, prepared for strong winds, ridiculous amounts of snow. In some ways, you know, how wet it was going to be as well. But yeah, I was more worried about failing. I think I would have probably beaten myself up quite badly had we failed it, even though I identified already that it was quite a big chance.
I know you had some support from various sponsors, and I think probably now's the time to talk about gear, because you mentioned earlier on that you sort of approached it from a fairly lightweight point of view. And I see from your sort of outdoor CV, you've done a lot of adventure racing, etc. So it's sort of a mentality that once it gets into your mind, you approach everything that way. So what was had you stripped back the kit to?
Some of it's just really basic stuff. We both compared kit, you know, just compared to each other's kit in the end. So we made a list of what we had for Svalbard, changed that to suit a kind of potentially wetter environment, and then just went through each other's kit lists and tore it apart, basically. So Neil thought mine was quite luxurious because I had three pairs of socks, and he went with maybe two. I took soft shell trousers. Neil didn't take trousers. He just wore some sort of fleece onesie for when it was really cold, and his waterproof trousers. So it was pretty much just cutting back as much as we could and as much as possible. We didn't take anything really spare. We had in the end spare thermal clothes and all for when it got really cold, but didn't end up using them because our sleeping bags were brilliant for the conditions that we encountered. So it was just trying to judge each bit of kit and how much we were going to use it and how much we really needed it, because ultimately you've got to then drag that behind you.
You had, as you say, you had expedition foods there, but what were you using for a stove?
I've got an MSR. I think it's International, Universal, one of the ones, one of the two. So we have one of those with Coleman's fuel. So all our research had told us before that Coleman's fuel was probably the best we can use, so that's what we used.
And one of the questions I usually ask is actually what was your best piece of kit and your worst piece of kit, considering the trip that you actually did?
Yeah, I think I had a list actually of things that when I was out there I was writing down each day the, you know, best bits of kit I had. And one of the best bits that we bought before we went away, we decided to buy some Sil nylon bags. Nothing extravagant, they're about a tenner each. Waterproof except for the zips, absolutely brilliant. Kept all of our kit together in the poles. Just a simple thing, so I was trying to trip like that. Kept everything dry, brilliant. That was one of my favourites. The watches as well, we both used Suntos while we were out there. And preloading a route onto a watch is absolutely amazing. I've used it for small like mountaineering trips before, but never on expedition. And I would definitely use it every time again, because when you get caught in a whiteout and you don't want to faff with your compass and or your GPS or trying to find a map, you just look at your wrist and it's there. It's so much easier. And it probably, you know, kept us going, and that we didn't have to stop and faff around with stuff and then get cold and then, you know, retake bearings and all. It was just there straight away for us to look at.
So ultimately then, when you looked at your kit list, etc., do you know what the actual weight of the kit was, as opposed to separate, keeping the food separate and stuff?
Off the top of my head now, I can't remember how much the kit was. I think all kit including skis, poles and any clothing, was probably around about 40 to 45 kilo mark.
Wow, okay, so it wasn't particularly light then.
No, even though we'd gone as light as possible, it wasn't massively light. Compared to what other trips have used, ours was relatively light. I think previous ones have, everything combined, have been up to and probably over 100 kilos. We managed to keep everything, including food, probably down to about 75, I think, in the end.
And what do you both feel you've learned about yourselves as a result of this?
I don't know. I think we've definitely learned a lot about each other's tolerances. We've obviously done trips together before, but not just the two of us. I think more our determination. We couldn't have really had a tougher time in that we were both ill. That definitely hammered us, but we both managed to pick ourselves up and drag ourselves on. And a lot of that was with support at home as well, knowing that we had support at home, and that my partner as well was, you know, messaging me on my InReach device. You know, I messaged her and said, you know, we were struggling. It's quite low at that point. She kind of gave me a bit of a kick and said, basically, suck it up. So, definitely a lot more about what I can actually tolerate and what I can overcome.
And you mentioned then that you were using an InReach device. So that was your safety backup system, I guess.
Yeah, we both had in reaches. We had a sat phone as well, so just in case, you know, really bad, we needed a sat phone. But yeah, the in reaches are pretty much foolproof anyway, so always going to take them on any trip we do.
What am I right in thinking you were doing this for charity ultimately?
Yeah, I was doing it for Cornwall Air Ambulance, so it's quite a big charity down in Cornwall. I try and do something kind of for a charity every year if I can. Just stemming back from a job I did a while ago. I decided to pick Cornwall Air Ambulance this year.
Okay, well, we'll put all the links to the various things you discuss and your social media as well, obviously, in the show notes to the podcast. But if you've listened to one of my podcasts before, you know what my final question is going to be. Of all the things I could have asked you about this, what should I have asked you?
I think, you know what, the one I was worried about you asking is about the sickness and diarrhoea, and I think you covered it. I was, maybe about our toilet habits. That was pretty horrendous in a blizzard. We even contemplated how we could possibly go out to the toilet in a 75 miles an hour wind. Even got to the point where we thought we were going to have to use the survival shelter, dig a hole and sit in a survival shelter so that we didn't get frozen whilst going to the toilet. that's how desperate we got.
I'm not surprised. I mean, when you actually said it was sickness and diarrhea, I was thinking, good grief, you'd have to make sure you're facing the right way, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So you're up for another trip like this? Have you got anything else planned now?
Not for a year or so, at least. I'm going to enjoy. I say enjoy. I'll do something. Try and do something a little bit less punishing, I think, and go back and do some more like mountaineering-based trips. There's obviously more Arctic stuff I want to do, which I've kind of batted about in my head and got a few notes and ideas, but nothing major for a year or so. Just try and chill out and do something simple for a bit.
Excellent. Well, I shall, as I say, put the links to the charity connection and to your social media on the show notes as well. So, and I know the charity page will be open for a while, so if people feel they'd like to make a donation, particularly that Cornwall is so similar to Iceland, so they can support you in some way. But thanks very much indeed for your time. Sounds like a fantastic journey, and certainly the pictures do tell many a story. So I shall let people listen to this, look at the pictures, and think about going to a toilet in a 75 mile an hour wind in icy conditions.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
For people that have spent time in the hills and experienced the joys of outdoor toilet habits, you are now probably visualising how tough their sickness would make any expedition. For those listeners who have never had to or wanted to go in the woods, as they say, all I can say is it gives you a whole new appreciation for porcelain and the privacy of a warm room and a door. So what an experience, and well recounted by Ben. He's almost halfway to reaching his £1,500 target for the Cornwall Air Ambulance. So if this podcast has whetted your appetite for Iceland or other Scandinavian adventures, please add a small donation for a good cause, particularly at this time where the Air Ambulance may actually be needed for those suffering in remote places with this virus. Well, that's about it from me. Keep in touch on my social media, on the newsletter on the Outdoor Station, or subscribe to the YouTube channel to find out when my next live stream will be appearing, hopefully next week. Until then, look after yourself, folks, and take care of the family and those you love around you. And bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.